The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Rendell.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Friday, everyone. We made it through another week. Well, almost. You know, you never know with this administration what can happen on a Friday afternoon. Anything is possible. But it is Friday. And, you know, I was looking through Twitter, trying to keep up with everything that's happening in the few minutes before the show begins. And I came across an article in the Washington Post about how difficult it is to file a sexual harassment claim if you work in Congress. Now, you could be a lowly staffer on Capitol Hill or higher up. There's a procedure that you have to go through, and it's really cumbersome. It's pretty stunning. The only mandatory training for congressional employees, according to this Washington Post article, is an ethics program that was put into place after the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal in 2006. Oh, and there's some instruction on cybersecurity. There is a lack of mandatory anti-harassment training in Congress, as opposed to any other industry that you, one might work in. I remember working for Clear Channel. That was my last full-time job. And there were all kinds of mandatory trainings we had to go through. We had to go through a lot of training on what you can and can't say on the air and what can happen to you if you utter an expletive. They take it pretty seriously because the FCC can fine you upwards of $300,000 if you do. But there's also a lot of anti-harassment training that every employee in most major corporations have to go through. Let me play for you Jackie Speier. She's a congresswoman from California. First, she's launching Me Too Congress. So she had a Me Too experience when she was working in a congressional office before she joined Congress.
Like so many of you, I have a Me Too story to share. I was working as a congressional staffer. The chief of staff held my face, kissed me, and stuck his tongue in my mouth.
Lovely.
So I know what it's like to keep these things hidden deep down inside. I know what it's like to lie awake in bed at night wondering if I was the one who had done something wrong. I know what it's like years later to remember that rush of humiliation and anger. You know what? Many of us in Congress know what it's like because Congress has been a breeding ground for a hostile work environment for far too long. That's why I'm reaching out to congressional staff and to former congressional staff to share their Me Too Congress stories if they feel comfortable in doing so. There is nothing to fear in telling the truth. Wow. And it's time to throw back the curtain on the repulsive behavior that until now has thrived in the dark without consequences. The time is now. Join Me Too Congress, and together we will bring justice for all of us.
So you might be wondering, okay, so Jackie Speier opened the door and the floodgates should open. Why don't other women come forward? Because you know the halls of Congress has got to be rife with this kind of behavior. Well, with this Washington Post article was a video, and it's Jackie Speier explaining what you have to do to file a sexual harassment complaint in Congress, and it will blow your mind.
You know, the Congress of the United States should be an example for the rest of the country.
Should be.
For corporate America, yep. for the education establishment, for the military. And frankly, we're just the reverse. We're the worst example. The Office of Compliance, before you could even file a complaint, requires the victim to go through 30 days of counseling. And then after the 30 days of counseling, they have up to 15 days to file a complaint. And then they are required to be subject to mediation for another 30 days.
Oh, my God.
And then, and only then, after those two periods of time and a cooling off period of time, they can file a complaint. I mean, I've always felt that the reason why we don't address it in Congress is we don't want to make it seem like it goes on when we know it goes on. And oftentimes, it's only a very courageous victim who goes out of the system and files a complaint in court months later that we even hear about it. I think that if someone has been sexually harassed, if they're working in a hostile work environment, they should be able to file a complaint.
You think?
Period. And then that should be independently investigated. The perpetrator, whether it's other staff or the member, should pay a price, frankly. Right now, the cost of any settlement comes out of the U.S. Treasury. It does not even come out of the member's allowance.
It's amazing.
There's no penalty.
Amazing.
It's an embarrassment, and we've got to fix it. It is designed to protect Congress to the detriment of the victim, the staff member, who has done nothing wrong. So I am of the mind that this whole process has got to be subject to a wholesale reform.
You think? So back to this Washington Post article. I mean, that's stunning. Absolutely mind-blowing. What do they say? The fish rots from the head down? I think Trump said that, didn't he? The Office of Compliance sends newsletters and regular emails urging chiefs of staff to prioritize staff training and describing how to access resources online. While the office oversees tens of thousands of employees, only about 800 people since 2015 have taken the 20-minute online tutorial on preventing sexual harassment. 800 out of tens of thousands of people. Let's see. Chuck Grassley told the Post this week that if the law is not effectively accomplishing sexual harassment prevention and anti-discriminatory training, then it should be revisited. You think? You want to know what the problem is? Let's go to the next paragraph. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said members need to take responsibility for anti-harassment training in their own offices. Jackie Speier, the congresswoman we just heard in those two clips, led an effort in 2014 to make the training mandatory. It was defeated. But Pelosi told the Post she supports Speier's efforts. Isn't that nice of her? On Thursday, just yesterday, Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence, a Democrat from Michigan, introduced a bill to require sexual harassment training in Congress. It's just incredible how far we have to go. So today we find out there's two more women who've come forward in the Mark Halpern story. This one's not going away. And poor Mika Brzezinski had to talk about it again this morning on Morning Joe, saying that although they're friends, she and Joe support NBC's decision to suspend Halpern. I don't think he'll be back. I don't think he'll be back anywhere. Apparently, there were plans for another book, another Game Change 2, dealing with the 2016 election. And HBO was going to make another movie out of it, like they did with the first Game Change. Those have both been killed, those two projects. I feel sorry for John Heilman because he seems like a good guy through all this. Mark Halpern is the dick in more ways than one, apparently. Oh, boy. All right. So coming up today, Gaius Publius. Okay. Sorry about that. Moon Truth said, please don't give Trump credit for the fish rots from the head down. You've been using that line for 20 plus years. I get it. He made that up like he made up priming the pump. That's all I was saying. He takes credit for everything. Yeah. All right. So Gaius Publius is going to be here today to talk a bit about how we're seeing the shock doctrine playing out in real time in Puerto Rico, to talk about neoliberals. Oh, yeah. Neoliberalism. It's infecting us all. We'll talk about all that with Gaius Publius after a look at the day's news. We'll have who do we have? Doug Christian coming up from the Talk Media News Service after, my computer has been acting up again. I'll be spending the weekend, just in case you're wondering, wiping my hard drive clean and reinstalling Windows and all my software, hoping to get everything working the way it's supposed to be. In the meantime, let's check in with what's news, shall we?
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
2,800 documents related to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy were released on Thursday in compliance with the 1992 law. But the president bowed to protests in a last-minute campaign by the CIA and FBI by withholding thousands of additional papers for another 6 months of review. Administration officials said there was no cover-up, just an effort to avoid compromising national security, law enforcement, or intel gathering methods. It should be noted that the government had 25 years to review the documents and prepare for their release on October 26th. The newly released documents can be seen at archives.gov. Trump on Thursday declared the opioid crisis a national public health emergency and touted really big, really great advertising against drug use.
One of the things our administration will be doing is a massive advertising campaign to get people, especially children, not to want to take drugs in the first place, because they will see the devastation and the ruination it causes to people and people's lives. Watch what happens if we do our jobs, how the number of drug users and the addicted will start to tumble downward over a period of years. It will be a beautiful thing to see.
The declaration disappointed state officials and public health experts, who say a lot more money is needed. Some experts had urged Trump to trigger another category of national emergency under the Stafford Act, which can unlock more federal resources and emergency powers, but is usually used for more clearly delineated disasters like hurricanes or fires.
Beyond the shocking death toll, the terrible measure of the opioid crisis includes the families ripped apart, and for many communities, a generation of lost potential and opportunity. This epidemic is a national health emergency. Unlike many of us, we've seen, and what we've seen in our lifetimes, nobody has seen anything like what's going on now. As Americans, we cannot allow this to continue. It is time to liberate our communities from this scourge of drug addiction. Never been this way. We can be the generation that ends the opioid epidemic. We can do it. That is why, effective today, my administration is officially declaring the opioid crisis a national public health emergency under federal law, and why I am directing all executive agencies to use every appropriate emergency authority to fight the opioid crisis.
The Government Accountability Office has agreed to investigate the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity in response to a letter last week from Senators Michael Bennet of Colorado, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, and Cory Booker of New Jersey, raising concerns the panel's work may diminish the public's confidence in the democratic process. Trump established the commission after charging, with no evidence, that millions of undocumented immigrants voted in the 2016 election. The new U.S. ambassador to Canada, Kelly Kraft, who assumed her duties on Monday, told the CBC that she believes in both sides of the debate surrounding climate change.
Do you yourself believe in climate change?
I believe there are scientists that are both on both sides that are accurate.
You believe that there's scientists that science that proves that there is, man is not causing climate change?
Well, I think that both sides have, you know, they have their own results from their studies, and I appreciate and I respect both sides of the science.
Kraft, a major donor to the Republican Party, is married to Joe Kraft, president and CEO of one of the largest coal producers in the eastern U.S., who actively criticized the climate policies of the Obama administration. Hedge fund manager turned environmental billionaire and progressive activist Tom Steyer committed $10 million to launch an ad campaign advocating for the impeachment of Donald Trump. This ad is currently running all over cable news.
He's brought us to the brink of nuclear war, obstructed justice at the FBI, and in direct violation of the Constitution, he's taken money from foreign governments and threatened to shut down news organizations that report the truth. If that isn't a case for impeaching and removing a dangerous president, then what has our government become? I'm Tom Steyer, and like you, I'm a citizen who knows it's up to us to do something. It's why I'm funding this effort to raise our voices together and demand that elected officials take a stand on impeachment. A Republican Congress once impeached a president for far less. Yet today, people in Congress and his own administration know that this president is a clear and present danger, who's mentally unstable and armed with nuclear weapons. And they do nothing. Join us and tell your member of Congress that they have a moral responsibility to stop doing what's political and start doing what's right. Our country depends on it.
Trump was apparently watching TV early Friday morning as he tweeted in response, "Wacky and totally unhinged Tom Steyer, who has been fighting me and my Make America Great Again agenda from the beginning, never wins elections." Two more women have come forward to allege that Mark Halperin sexually harassed them while he was political director at ABC News a decade ago. The fallout continues as Penguin Press canceled the much-anticipated 2016 edition of Game Change, and HBO has dropped its plans for the movie version of the book as well. I got good news. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution. My work is 100% listener-funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. For a look at what else is happening in the news, we turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service, TalkMediaNews.com, and Doug Christian is on the line. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Nicole. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there. We've got a little bit of a cold snap going on here in South Florida, so that's nice for a change.
Yeah, that's needed, actually.
Yes.
South Florida.
So
that was interesting. What you mentioned about the, it's very tragic. But also indicative of how the general public sometimes views the media when we saw the Mark Halperin story, because he had been one who had criticized President Trump for having been
actually he didn't really criticize President Trump. I think he said something along the lines of, "Well, it's not illegal to do what he did." He seemed to have made excuses for him. I remember interviewing Mark Halperin once. It was 2007 or 2008. He had a book out. It was still fairly early in the 2008 election cycle primary process. And he wrote about all of the candidates on both sides of the aisle who were running, and the best and worst case scenarios. And for Hillary Clinton, the worst case scenario was that she'd get into the White House and Bill Clinton would embarrass her and put the country at risk by having another illicit affair or something. It was just so heinous and so offensive. And he and I got into an argument on the air about it because I found what he said so offensive. So this is somebody who's just, I was shocked, but I wasn't surprised when I heard this.
Yeah, I think that's the basic. That's basically what you're hearing: shocked but not surprised. And it's sad. It's sad for the women who went through it. It's sad, for his wife or girlfriend, and for it's just shocking because it hits close to home with many people who didn't think that. That this was going to touch them so closely.
Yeah, but we're seeing it in all corners now. We got, of course, the media. You have Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly and Mark Halperin and all them. You have, obviously, Hollywood with Harvey Weinstein and the guy from Amazon and the guy from Hulu. And, more and more, it seems like more and more people or women are coming forward to talk about what happened. I played a clip earlier from Congresswoman Jackie Speier talking about when she was sexually harassed by a member, not a member, but by somebody in a congressional office when she was you know, long before she ever became a member of Congress herself, but worked on Capitol Hill. We found out how difficult it is to file a complaint in Congress if you are sexually harassed. Boy, talk about a backward organization. There's a great story in the Washington Post today about it. It's absolutely chilling what a woman has to go through, or anyone has to go through. I mean, counseling, 30 days of counseling before you can even file a complaint, and then mediation before you can even file a complaint. There's no HR department to go to. So it's really backwards.
Hey, well, this is a wake-up call to men that thinking that men are going to get away with this, they ought to think twice. That it may most likely come out from now on, and it could ruin your career.
Well, it should.
Absolutely.
It absolutely should. You know, with all the Me Too stories going around, you know, you have to wonder about the women who work in industries that are not in the public eye, and the recourse that they face, you know, should they come forward. But you know, women are feeling empowered now, so that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I feel it's great. I mean, progress. I mean, progressives believe in moving forward, and this is part of moving our society forward, is taking care of dirty laundry, cleaning it up, and getting rid of this kind of behavior in our society. Not that it's going to be easy, but we have to do it.
That's right. So, Doug, what else is going on today? Any big news stories we need to know about?
Well, there is this kind of running controversy over what Hillary Clinton knew or what she had done with the Russians in order to make the Uranium One deal.
That's such a non-story. You know what? That's really non-story. That was a story that happened in 2010. It was alleged in that horrible book, Clinton Cash, in 2015. And Fox and the Trump administration want something to take people's attention away from what's really going on. So Fox turned it into a story again. It's really a non-story. Do you have any real news?
But I'm debating people about that. I mean, like, because there are a lot of people who believe that. Anyway,
yeah, because they watch Fox.
this is true. Also, of course, there is this looming Republican debate over what they're going to do with the budget resolution. Mm. Because, of course, the tax cuts, of course, is their god. And yet, at the same time, they also believe in balancing the budget. Well, they really can't have both. Now, they publicly say, well, if we cut taxes, that will increase revenue for government because of increased economy. But privately, they know better. And and one of the places that the Republicans are looking to boost revenue is to deny tax breaks, federal tax breaks, for high tax states, the taxes that people pay into high
local taxes, right?
Right, primarily blue states, but not all.
Of course.
And of course, I mean that is. I mean, people like Representative Peter King are not happy.
Well, he
in New York.
He actually voted against the budget the other day. That out of the 20 no Republican votes, I think 11 of them were from New York and New Jersey. And I was trying to figure out, there are six states that this is really going to hit hard. It's New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Illinois, and there's one more that I'm losing now. I figured out the six of them the other day, and now I've lost one again. But yeah, because when you live in California, I lived in both New York and California most of my adult life, and you have to pay state and local taxes, but you can deduct them from your federal income tax returns. If they do away with that deduction, that's going to hurt a lot of people.
It sure is. And in fact, they shouldn't call it tax cuts. What they should do is call it a tax shift, basically from middle class to corporations, because what they're really looking to do here is to cut tax the corporate tax rate, and the only way they can do it is to find the revenue in other places. At first, they were trying to find that revenue from cutting health benefits to large swaths of the population. That didn't work. So now they're looking to do it this way. Both ways are not really tax cuts per se. They're tax shifts from one demographic to another.
Right. The other thing that's up in the air that I guess we'll find out on Wednesday, because that's the day that they're supposed to release the text of the bill that to this point still doesn't exist for their tax so-called reform. And that's how much money you can sock away in a 401k tax deferred. So right now, if you're wealthy enough, you can put away $18,000 a year tax deferred into a 401k with the idea being that you'll withdraw it once you retire and you're in a lower tax bracket, so you'll pay less in taxes than you would if you pay it up front. They're talking about lowering that to $2,400 a year. Again, this is supposed to be tax cuts for the middle class. This is tax cuts for the wealthiest among us, and it's going to hurt the middle class.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. I feel that the Democrats' biggest challenge right now is to figure out how to brand their message, because I feel that one thing Donald Trump was very good at was branding his message, however warped that message was. He actually was able to kind of give it a logo and a symbol and these kind of things. And I feel that the Democrats need to figure out the most pithy thing to say and say it again and again, to make sure that people understand exactly the stakes of what's happening.
Yeah, Democrats aren't very good at that.
No, no. I mean, make what is it, a better solution? I mean,
a better deal.
Hello?
It's a better deal.
Better deal?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. I mean, that's so weak.
Do you remember a movie from, it had to have been the 70s, called The Candidate with Robert Redford? If not,
oh, I love that movie.
It's a great movie, but it's, I forget his name was like McKay or something. It would be McKay for a better way. That's what it reminds me of. And the thing is, at the end, yeah, he gets elected and then he says, now what do we do? And that's how the movie ends. That's what they remind me of. They just don't seem to have it together. That plus they seem to be pushing all the wrong candidates instead of helping the progressives, knowing that Bernie Sanders is the most popular political figure we have right now, according to every poll that's taken. The Democratic Party is trying to lessen the impact of progressive candidates for 2018. They're really, really hurting them in favor of blue dogs and new Dems, who are the Republican wing of the Democratic Party. So they just shoot themselves in the foot over and over again. It's a circular firing squad on the left.
Yeah, they are, and they're denying their own strength. And here's the funny thing. I mean, you look at somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who has this very, very vigorous following, and the Democrats kind of like, oh yeah, but she's on the left. Oh yeah, but she's not really mainstream. No, she just happens to be a senator, and the reason she happens to be a senator is that the Republicans, and it was specifically George W. Bush, Obama, wanted to appoint her to financial consumer protection, mm-hmm. and the Republicans stonewalled that. And
that's
said,
right.
No. Yeah. And so, okay.
And that's why she's a senator. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why she's a senator. So they gave her the Senate seat by freeing her up to run. If they had just allowed her to be anonymous in Washington Consumer Protection, that was her.
Right,
was her
to run the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which now they're trying to dismantle anyway. They would have been smarter to do that. But no, I'm hoping Elizabeth Warren steps up and runs in 2020.
She's absolutely eloquent. She's fluent. And of course, she was my senator for a little bit before I moved to D.C. And I remember her well when she was getting into her fights with Larry Summers over at Harvard.
Yeah.
And she's been articulate and passionate. And I think she would be an amazing candidate. I think that many Democrats, again, it gets back to what you said earlier, though. I think the Democratic Party is thinking, uh-oh, what do you mean we're going to get some left-wing person running? They're not really embracing the idea that maybe the Democratic Party is the liberal party. It should probably stand up for progressive and liberal ideas.
Yeah, they need to learn that, but they're not learning it on the congressional side. So we've got a long way to go. Anyway, Doug Christian from the Talk Media News Service at talkmedianews.com. Thank you so much, Doug. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too, Nicole.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye.
We got Gaius Publius coming up, so we'll check in with Jim Hightower, come back with Gaius Publius, and talk about the shock doctrine playing itself out in Puerto Rico next.
On pushing a Medicare for All health care bill, Democratic congressional leaders are weaker than Canadian hot sauce. I'll tell you about it today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown. Good news, people! At last, congressional Democrats have gotten a clue, grown some spine, and are beginning to act like, well, like Democrats. In particular, a majority of Dems in the U.S. House are responding to the rising public demand that decent health care be treated as a right for everyone, rather than being rationed by profiteering insurance conglomerates. Nearly 6 of 10 in the House have now signed on to Representative John Conyers' Medicare for All bill, which is being carried in the Senate by Bernie Sanders. So, hallelujah, progress. Yes, but there are many speed bumps to overcome before the Democratic Party gets onto the moral high road of politics. Representative Nancy Pelosi, for one. When the leader of House Democrats was asked if the party should make health care for all a major issue in Congress and in the 2018 elections, she replied with a flat no. Basically, Pelosi says the American people aren't ready for it, by which she really means that the narrow slice of the public that inhabits her world, health industry executives, lobbyists, and campaign donors, aren't ready. Meanwhile, a good 60% of regular Americans are damn sure ready, telling pollsters that our government has a responsibility to ensure that everyone gets the care they need. Let's be blunt. When it comes to the fiery leadership that America's grassroots people want and need, the Democratic Party establishment is weaker than Canadian hot sauce. When you've got 60% of your party's rank-and-file congressional members ready to go, and 60% of the public is also ready to go, it's time to go. The National Party's leadership must get going on health care for all, or the leadership itself must go. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help push both the party and the health care for all issue forward, go to nationalnursesunited.org.
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you, the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
Can't afford a monthly donation? Is that what's getting you down, Bunky? But maybe you shop on Amazon.com occasionally?
Well then, just use the NicoleSandler.com Amazon portal, and we'll get a small commission on all your purchases.
But I just bought...
Don't worry, we can't see what you bought.
Just bookmark Amazon through the NicoleSandler.com portal and use it. Every purchase helps Nicole stay on the air.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All rise for Gaius Publius.
That's not his real name.
You call Gaius Publius into question?
Sure.
Very well. For the audience at home.
What is the real name of Gaius Publius?
Gaius Publius.
Wow! Another winner!
Joins Nicole Sandler on NicoleSandler.com.
Hello, Gaius Publius.
Hello, Nicole. You make me smile every time.
Well, that's good. That's what it's supposed to do. It makes me smile, too. So I hear you got a little cold under the weather up there. Is it hot as hell in Oregon, too?
No, it's not. San Jose was warm last couple of days, but we've been through weather changes, and I pick up a cold a couple days ago. I'm in the nasal phase. I hope your audience won't mind.
You sound fine. You sound fine. So, Gaius Publius, you blog twice a week. You have a piece up at downwithtyranny.com. And this week, you're writing a lot about neoliberalism. And the piece that you wrote Monday is the one that really caught my eye, Shocking the Shock Doctrine, What Recovery in Puerto Rico Could Look Like. We're seeing Naomi Klein's shock doctrine play out in real time. And it's just the beginning of it, aren't we?
Well, in terms of these storms, absolutely, yes. In terms of all of the climate damage, in fact.
Yeah, because the shock doctrine, the other part of the title of her 2007 book is The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And it talks about how the neo-libs take advantage of disasters to rebuild. We saw it play out in New Orleans after Katrina, where out of the ashes of the hurricane rose all these privately funded charter schools. They got rid of a lot of the lower cost housing and they put, you know, expensive homes up in their place. It is disaster capitalism. It's rising from the ashes of a disaster to enrich the already wealthy.
Yeah, they turned what was, I don't know the demographic percentages, but a largely black city into, or attempted to turn into, a largely white city with a theme park in the middle called the French Quarter.
Right.
And very much like Disney, you know, you can bring all your safe little kids to Pirates of the Caribbean, and not a hair on their head will be harmed.
That's right. So now we're watching what's going on in Puerto Rico. I just read something horrendous that I have no doubt is true, where one news organization, and I can't remember who it was, sent a reporter down to talk to the medical examiners because they weren't trusting the death toll, which now officially stands at around 51. And a medical examiner said they have given approval for over 955 people to be cremated, people who've died of, quote, natural causes since Hurricane Maria hit the island. So there will never be an accurate count of how many people have died as a result of this storm.
Yeah, and it's not just the storm that's the perp. An awful lot of people who have died since the storm. As has been reported, a lot of the disaster occurs after the disaster. It's in the recovery phase.
Of course.
And the real perps on this are the holders of the billions and billions of dollars of Puerto Rico's government bonds, bought much of it by hedge funds for pennies on the dollar, attempting to use the U.S. government as their enforcer, their strong-arm enforcer, to make sure that Puerto Rico pays up. And this happens under both parties. The attempt to strong-arm Puerto Rico actually occurred under Obama, and it's being continued under Trump. But the people who own these hedge funds are hiding behind holding companies that have bought them. There's one guy in Boston. His name is Seth Klarman. He's one of the richest hedge fund members, people in the world. His group is called the Baupost Group, or the Bauport Group. I can't read my own handwriting here. They've got $1 billion themselves, bought through subsidiaries that they've hidden behind, 10 entities. And the guy lives in Boston. Boston has a large Puerto Rico community. So there's a group in Boston that's going to try to out him to the Puerto Rico community as a man who is their resident, who is responsible for the austerity squeeze that continues and accelerates under the storm.
Wow. Right after the storm hit and it started clearing, Trump took to Twitter and wrote something about, you know, we need to forgive Puerto Rico's debt in order to move forward. And then, you know, somebody like called him and said, what are you talking about? You're not going to forgive their debt. And then all of a sudden that narrative was gone. And now to the point where the Senate both chambers of Congress actually passed a bill for recovery for the storms and the fires in California. They rolled them all into one like $36.5 billion bill. But for Puerto Rico, what they get out of it is a $5 billion loan. It's not a grant.
Yep.
It's not money for recovery. It's a loan to put on top of the money that they're already indebted for. How is that fair?
Well, it's fair to predators.
I guess.
It's not fair to prey. And that's really what this is about. This is about predators and prey. In the United States, we don't like to think of white people preying on white people.
Mm-hmm.
But we have no problem thinking of white people preying on brown people.
Right.
And that's exactly what's going on in Puerto Rico. Look at the difference between the Virgin Islands, the American U.S. Virgin Islands, for example, and the what's going on in Puerto Rico. People in the United States don't think of the Virgin Islands as predominantly black because they are predominantly English-speaking.
Right.
Whereas it's easy to think of Puerto Rico as predominantly other because Puerto Rico is like a 95% Spanish-speaking island. The school system is in Spanish.
Right. And so, they're the others. New Orleans had some of that because New Orleans was predominantly black. You know, I wonder, and we responded better to Haiti in their last big, it was an earthquake actually that hit them. We responded better to them than we did to Puerto Rico, which is shocking to me. But the point you make about the Virgin Islands, the difference is pretty interesting. The Americans just don't know that much about the Virgin Islands, I guess.
No, and it even the word virgin sounds so white, doesn't it? I mean, there's something about the overtone.
Yes. It does.
So about Haiti, just to make a side point, Nicole, we don't own Haiti.
That's true.
So we can't control them. We can only help them. And by the way, the Clinton Foundation got into Haiti, if I remember this correctly, and managed to get a whole bunch of grants. But the grants were so that people could build resorts and things like that. So it's not loans.
Right.
It's grants.
Right.
But it helped the middle. It helped the upper middle class and the very wealthy, and it's going to help turn Haiti into a better playground for the wealthy. The plan in Virgin Islands, there's a whole lot of stuff going on. I'm sorry, in Puerto Rico. There's a whole lot of stuff going on there. But if you want to think of a headline issue, think of buying up wrecked land along the seafront and turning it into 5-star resorts and golf courses.
Of course. And that's what the goal is. So all these people that are holding all the debt, if Puerto Rico can't repay the debt, they'll say, okay, we'll take the land. We'll just own it. You guys can work there and we'll build these 5-star resorts and have more of a playground for the wealthy, for the rich and famous.
Right. Of course, that kind of scenario, that's an archetype scenario, is being played out in all of the areas of recovery. This is my cold talking here.
Okay.
For example, the rebuilding of the electrical energy generation.
Now, you know, that's a whole new story in and of itself with this little company out of Montana that up until the day they were granted the $300 million contract, they had 2 full-time employees. There was a lot made out of, maybe it's because it's the same town that Ryan Zinke is from, the Secretary of the Interior. They're denying that that had anything to do with it. I saw an interview on MSNBC earlier today with Stephanie Rule and a spokesman from that company. And he was basically saying we were the only ones willing to go there and do the work because the Puerto Rico Energy Authority, I forget the official name of them, nobody wants to work with them because they don't have any money.
Well, yes, there's that. But there's also 2 other aspects. One is that some dots just connect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that outfit is either godfathered or funded or something by a big Trump donor. The fact that it's associates of Ryan Zinke, didn't hurt them at all. This is that classic case. Remember during the Bush era of basically 2 post-college students who decided to become arms contractors, and they made a fortune basically middlemanning armaments into Iraq. And got a nice little sweetheart contract from the DOD.
Mm-hmm.
The second aspect of this, though, is when you rebuild Puerto Rico's electrical generation capability, what do you rebuild? Do you rebuild natural gas? Do you rebuild coal? Do you rebuild oil? Mm-hmm. Or do you rebuild distributed solar systems that aren't connected to a single grid? aren't sourced to a single place so that they can't be taken out so easily.
Right.
If neighborhoods, for example, have rooftop solar and those neighborhoods are connected to each other, they can get up and running a lot faster than it will be for going to find $1 billion to rebuild or repair a coal-fired plant sitting in the middle of the island.
That's right. And what did I, you know, the Tesla guy, whose name I'm blanking on right now, who offered to go in and set up the island with solar. They did go in and they got at least one hospital online through solar. But I guess that's not the plan for the entire island. I don't know how this whitefish energy is doing it, but I'm sure it's not through solar.
Yes, it's not through solar. I'm certain that if Zinke's involved, or if friends of Zinke are involved, it's going to be through. It's going to be an opportunity to continue the enhancement of the carbon extraction industry.
Of course. So, Gaius Publius,
Ironically, exacerbates the climate change that brought that storm in the first place.
That's right. And so, I mean, it's just counting the days. It could be days or weeks. We've got another month still in hurricane season. Hurricane season doesn't end until November 30th. So I'm knocking on wood laminate that we steer clear of all these storms for the rest of the year. But they're only bound to happen more and more often as the planet keeps heating up. This is a topic you've written about a whole lot, Gaius.
Yeah. I'm kind of keeping an eye on two big stories because they are both world historical stories. And why be a commenter if you can't comment on the big things? The two big stories are the wealth transfer under late stage capitalism, modern late stage capitalism, that's going to break the world. Mm-hmm. And hopefully I'm alive long enough to watch it break, hopefully from a safe seat. And the second story is the refusal to address climate change by the generation that thinks it's going to be the next generation that will pay the price. They don't understand it's going to be their generation themselves that will pay the price. There are people who are 30 today who will wish they had done something 10 years. In 10 years, they will wish they had done something 10 years ago.
Yeah, because this is going faster than anyone thought. If we think back, you know, 10 years, you think about when you first heard of 350.org, it was long before we had hit 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. That's what that number was a warning on. And then not only did we hit it, but we surpassed it, and things have been rising, temperatures at an exponential rate. Every month seems to be the hottest ever on record, and then the next month comes by and we break new records.
The last 3 or 4 years have seen an exponential rise, you're right, or something that looks like exponential rise.
Yes. And so we're going to see, I read something the other day about, Superstorm Sandy. Remember, it was supposed to be a 1-in-500-year storm. Well, now they're saying we could have one of those every 5 years.
Yes. And the strongest argument for that climate change is real is actually from statistics, which unfortunately is something that goes right past most people. But the phrase a 1-in-500-year storm is a reference to the statistical probability of something occurring. They call that like 4 or 5 standard deviations away from the norm or the bell-shaped curve, the fat part of the bell-shaped curve. Mm-hmm. Well, those 5 sigma events are becoming 2 sigma events very reliably, and it's really obvious that we're in for it. People think that the climate change will be linear. Climate change effects will be linear because they look, for example, at the Keeling curve, that curve of CO2 in the atmosphere that's being kept at Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, and that looks roughly linear with a little bit of an up curve at the end. Well, the consequences won't be linear at all. They'll be turbulent. And we're starting to see that turbulence where all of a sudden something that should have been only 10% worse than last year becomes double the problem of last year, then drops back to 10% worse than 2 years ago, and then becomes double again. Hmm. And these doubling events, these things that happen double are destructive in a huge way. I saw something from NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, that said that we have crossed something like, I'm trying to remember the number, $27 billion catastrophic events in the United States this year.
Wow.
The wildfires in California and the Pacific Northwest have allowed that to cross that line. That's like setting a record. I may be wrong about the 27, but we have set a record. How many billion-dollar destructive events have occurred in 20, I think it's 2017 that they measured, which means we're not over with that yet. Now, think of the insurance companies when you think of that. Those people are under enormous stress. And think of the amount of stress that Congress will be under to make companies whole who have to deal with that, to backstop these companies to the tune of that money, and the resistance in Congress to doing that.
Right.
Which means the resistance by the rich to doing that.
Yes. But now here's the other thing to look at, though, Gaius, which is when Obama was in charge, any time there was a bill that came up to pay for a disaster like this, they wanted to pay for. Right? Most Republicans would vote against it unless there was money to pay for the funds that were being asked for. With the Republicans in charge, they seem to forget that they have a problem with carrying a debt and deficit. And they seem to be happy to put it on a credit card. Although there were a number of them who did vote against this $37.5 billion bill just the other day for the disaster relief, which is not even which is a drop in the bucket as to the money that's needed to help out between Houston and Northern California and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and the Florida Keys. I mean, that doesn't even come close to scratching the surface of the money that's needed.
Right. And at some point, the very wealthy who control, I will say, both parties are simply going to say, we're not going to allow that money to be spent. Some people are just going to have to be abandoned. We're seeing that now in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. That's probably the obvious case. But just as it's not going to be linear, these disasters, the abandonment of undeserving people or the wrong people worldwide is not going to be is going to be allowed. If, for example, Bangladesh has millions and millions of people who are living very, very close to sea level, if at some point in 10 years that land becomes uninhabitable and you have millions and millions of refugees from Bangladesh, what do you think the world's response will be?
Nothing.
It's to let them die.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
India's already building a wall, and it's to let them die. We're going to see that in the United States again.
Wow.
In this generation.
Yeah, you've been writing this week a lot about neoliberalism. Can I ask you to define what neoliberalism is?
The piece you're referring to came up Thursday, and it's called Defining Neoliberalism. Thank you for bringing that up, because it's really one of the core problems. Neoliberalism is the belief that the marketplace is the right metaphor for all human activity, which means that human competition is the defining characteristic of human society, and competition is individuals, and that this competition is both right and good. It's good to have it, and it's morally right to have it. Therefore, in the early neoliberal days, government, this is now in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the job of government was to get out of the way of wealth creation, as the Democrats call it, or free market conservatism, as the Republicans call it. But late stage neoliberalism, as wealth has increased again, astronomically, exponentially, mm-hmm. and that curve really has gone exponential.
Yeah.
The wealth, the distribution of wealth, the concentration. The modern belief of neoliberals is that it's the job of government to enhance the increase of wealth among the very, very wealthy. So you see, for example, the government of the city of Chicago interfering in the market to proactively give parking meter revenues to what turned out to be ultimately the sovereign wealth fund of Abu Dhabi or Dubai. It's one of those two are the major owners of that, even though there was a pass-through through an American buyer at Citibank, I think, was the original group who put together the buyers of the good side of that contract, but they ended up after the contract was signed passing it on to a sovereign wealth fund in the Middle East.
Unbelievable.
But they did that proactively, and you see this under Democrats as well, where Obamacare is a perfect example, where the role of government is to, now this is how Democrats do it, let's be nice to the people while at the same time providing a wealth opportunity for an unnecessary part of society, which is the healthcare insurance industry. Republicans simply say, let's not be nice to the people and pass the money on anyway. A real socialist like Bernie Sanders would say, let's cut out the private sector on some of this stuff because healthcare ought to be treated like a utility.
Mm-hmm.
Like a government function, and let's create a totally publicly owned operation to do that. Neoliberalism on the conservative side is what you see on healthcare under Republicans. Neoliberalism on the Democratic side is the ACA. It's guaranteed wealth for the insurance companies with some sweeteners to make sure that they can say we're helping some people too.
Right. Okay. And so how does that relate to the disaster capitalism we're seeing, for instance, in Puerto Rico?
Well, once you say things are destroyed, once you see that things are destroyed, they're going to have to be rebuilt. And this destruction can occur either by natural disaster, as in Puerto Rico, or Naomi Klein's classic example of this occurred in the 70s in Chile under Pinochet.
Mm-hmm.
Once that was a political disaster. But once Pinochet's coup had murdered Allende, a democratically elected socialist in Chile, then Milton Friedman, the literal human person Milton Friedman and his group went down there to advise them. This was kind of a ground zero test for neoliberalism. Neoliberalism in 73 was not very popular as an ideology. It became more popular toward the late 70s. It was kind of a backwater ideology at the time. And they needed a test case, and Pinochet proved it perfectly. And they privatized everything in sight. They treated Chile like George W. Bush treated Iraq with all of that privatization that went on. So, yes, the shock doctrine provides a rich, cleared field for the application of neoliberal principles, which is to say, grow something back that isn't government-owned, where government protects the wealthy to come in and take care of it. Another example of neoliberalism and disaster is what's going on in Greece in terms of austerity.
Yes.
The price for help for Greece has been the privatization of all their airports and ports. Can you imagine the port of Piraeus, which goes back to the ancient Athenians, that the ancient Athenians owned the port of Piraeus? Is or will be in the hands of some hedge fund who has enough money to buy it. Because after all, who but the hedge funds now have enough money to buy these things?
Right. So looking forward, I mean, that's what's going to happen in Greece because they're so deep in debt. And there is an analogy to be made with Puerto Rico, who there's no way this island is going to be able to dig out of the debt, especially now with the disaster of Hurricane Maria on top of it. So something's got to give. And what's going to give is something to the big money hedge fund vulture capitalists who are going to take over the island in a way, I guess, that we haven't seen before.
And my metaphor has been, I think I expressed it in the piece, a neoliberal solution to disaster is, we'll rebuild your farm, but now we own it. And by the way, you have to work it for the next 50 years, you and your family.
Oh, God. The only thing the people of Puerto Rico have going for them right now is that they are American citizens and they don't need a visa to come to the mainland. And a lot of them are coming, they're coming to Florida. So it'll be interesting to see how that manifests itself and how many people wind up escaping from Puerto Rico because they're going to feel like they have to escape.
That should give your right-wing Cubans the vapors.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, Gaius Publius, we scratched the surface here. I'm going to put links on my blog today to both of those pieces we talked about, the shocking the shock doctrine and defining neoliberalism, because they're two important articles that you have up at downwithtyranny.com this week. Thank you so much for coming on and being under the weather. I really appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure, Nicole. Thank you.
Well, it's always great to talk with you, and we'll do it again soon. Thanks, Gaius. And with that, we are done for the day and done for the week, actually. As I said, I'll be rebuilding the computer this weekend and hoping that everything everything works out well in the end. If the computer allows me, we'll be back Tuesday with Gotta Laugh. As always, thanks for listening. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. See ya Tuesday.